Thanks very much. So my name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for the group for inviting me. It was Mark. I was on a meeting somewhere, sometime, someplace in the ether, and he invited me along to this meeting. So I'm very, very privileged and happy to be here. For not, and it's not early in the morning at all. This is Australia, so it's actually 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday. I know in Ireland it's 5 in the morning, and it's very, I must say straight up, when I had a little flag against my name, and I had an Australian flag and an Irish flag, because I remember talking to Mark about the fact I was born in Ireland. So it's nice to be in a meeting with the Gaelic top Gaelic words, tusnua, a new path, a new way. I really like that idea. And in fact, when I thought, no, it just occurred to me, I am on a new path. I am on a new path. I celebrated 30 years sobriety on the 20th of December, just gone. So only a few days ago. And I'm on a new path. And I think that's what I think that could be. I'm going to use that as a topic. I'm going to new path as my topic. I haven't thought about this because I always think the best stories are the ones that come from your heart in the moment and not from your brain from thinking. So I would just go with the flow. And as I say, I was born in Dublin in Ireland in 1954. And I was very, like I say, I'm an alcoholic, but I see myself as much as an addict with compulsive, obsessive behaviors. But I actually really saw the impact of alcoholism very early in my life. We talk about step one being powerless over our addictions or our behaviors. And I recognized in my father, who was a very violent alcoholic. And I know I recognized it very early because I was in Dublin, and we moved from Dublin when I was three. So I saw things between the age of 0 and 3 that even then, even though I couldn't articulate it, I saw some really kind of violent activity in my house. And I knew it was connected to alcohol. I knew it was connected to my father's drinking, because we had a household where it was okay when he wasn't drinking. It was very not okay when he was. And there was domestic violence before they'd invented the term. There was chaos and madness and blood on the wall and all sorts of stuff. And as I say, I know it was that time because I was in Dublin. My baby brother hadn't been born yet. So I start by saying that because that's really important to me, because kind of addictions and alcoholism have permeated my life, really, right to this minute, to this second. It's been a very powerful influence on my life. And the reason, and to go absolutely full circle, as into today, the reason I like the idea of the new path is because what I'm doing now is I'm exploring, and have done for some little time, the secular corner of these fellowships, the secular space. And it's been fabulous. I'm going to say that out loud because it's been a revelation for me. So I grew up in this alcoholic family, and there was, oh gosh, everything I've heard happened, suicide attempts, police, mental institutions, moving, doing moonlight flits, some people understand, running away from stuff. My father often got involved with some very unsavory people that he might owe something to, and there were times when we'd literally flee from the house in the back of a car to somewhere, with various children in tow, and bottles of whiskey being passed between my mother and father on the front seat and then rolling back towards us. I always remember this kind of Jameson's bottle of Jameson's was my oh I love seeing Jameson labels. If I'm passing through a airport these days, I always go and have a look at the Jameson whiskey labels, because they're bizarrely fond. I've got a bizarre fondness to them, like a childhood memory of the bottle rolling from the front seat of the car as my parents were careering through the night, and then rolled back to where me and my brothers were cowering, wondering what the hell's going on next. My two brothers, particularly, I was just kind of observing it almost like an alien in some ways, kind of, out-of-body experience, I suppose. And anyway, Mark said to me, there's no time limit. I mean, I wonder what happened if you actually did a sort of, a Fidel Castro or a and spoke for like 7 hours, would people just disappear gradually and new people would turn up? I just think it's, I don't know. Anyway, that just occurred to me, but I'm not going to do that. Don't you worry. I'm not that narcissistic. But I realize I'm already going through sort of blow by blow from, I think I'm about 4 years old by now. But anyway, so yeah, I love seeing Jameson's whiskey bottles, and I do that. And I look at the little creamy labels on the Jameson whiskey, and I have this kind of memory of childhood, but I also have a memory of the fact that that's what I used to like to drink. And I always used to think in my family, if there's a Jameson's bottle of whiskey in the family, there would be chaos and violence by the end of the night. But I swore blind I wouldn't follow my father's footsteps, because I watched him trying to deal with his mental, physical, emotional, spiritual malaise through drinking for decades. And I watched him in those days. I'm talking about the sort of 60s and 70s, 60s particularly, mental institutions. They used to lock up alcoholics, and he had electric shock therapies. And he was on some of the very early anti-abuse treatment programs. We were in England by this time. We did a geographical to England, to London, and ended up in London. I haven't got an Australian accent, in case you wondered. I've got a kind of a London accent, not an Irish accent. I'd like an Irish accent. In fact, if Tusnua can give me an Irish accent by sort of default, I'll be very happy, because I think it's the nicest accent on the planet. Maybe I'll just fake one. I'm sure you could go on the internet and get someone to coach you to speak in a particular accent. Maybe I'll try that, but not for now. I saw that all this happened to my dad, and I swore blind when I was a teenager that I wouldn't go drinking. And when I think about it, I kind of white knuckled my way. When my friends started drinking, they used to go into the pub, and I'd go and sit in the cinema and watch a movie just so I didn't drink. I'd watch some great movies, on my own, sitting there. I still like to do that now, actually. But then when I finally picked up a drink, I don't know if there's a genetic predisposition. I mean, I think the jury's still a little bit out on that one. But God Almighty, when I drank to blackout day one, blackout. And then for the next 25 years, I drank to blackout. To my mind, all the other substances available when they were available, I tried them out to oblivion. I was one of those kind of compulsive, addictive people that if someone said, lick this toad, lick this frog, it will make you feel different, I would lick the frog. I wouldn't ask you what was on the surface of the frog. Or if they said, here's a powder, stick it up your nose, it'll make you feel different. Here's a tablet, swallow it, it'll make you feel different. I wouldn't ask the chemical constitution of the substance. I'd just take it. And then if it made me feel different, I'd want all of it and everything else. And then I'd steal it from people. If I had it, I'd steal it from my best friend, which I did many a time, unfortunately. And I remember one time stealing some dope from this very good, very lovely, it just came into my mind as I said that, this very beautiful friend of mine, and we were at his party and I stole his dope, and he saw me do it, and he looked around at me and he said, Robert, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And I know why I did it, because I was an addict, I was a compulsive, addictive person. And that was more important than the friendship. And that's very sad. That's very sad thing to recall and remember. But I do recall and remember that. So you don't need all the blow-by-blow accounts, but for the next 25 years, as it says in the, in the literature, beautiful relationships were shattered, children were left crying in train, opportunities came and went, houses came and went. But most of all, I lost my kind of spirit. And when we talk about like a spiritual journey thing, I've always been on a sort of a spiritual journey of one description, right to this second, to being in this meeting. This to me is a spiritual experience, speaking at this meeting with all the beautiful people who I don't know here, all these lovely, how many? 20 people, that's a nice round number. If we could get to 25, I'd be very excited, because that's my lucky number, which I've had for many years. In fact, when my father used to beat my mother to a pulp, I used to put my fingers in my ears, and I'd count to 25, and I'd unpop them, And if it was still chaos and smashing and bashing, I'd stick my fingers back in my ear and I'd count to 25. And eventually, if you do that for long enough, it might take several hours, it stops. And then I realized it was a lucky number because eventually after 25 will stop. So if we could get five more people, that'd be nice. We'll see how the thing goes. So yeah, 25. In fact, yeah, I drink and drank and drugged for 25 years. And finally ended up, I was on the spiritual journey. Yeah, I was always on the spiritual journey. I was always, when I was a very young kid, I often tell this little anecdote, but it was the truth of it. I was about 7 years old and I wanted to find God. And I went to my brother, can you come with me? We'll go knock on the vicar's door and ask who God is. So we went, we were only kids. I was seven, he was nine. And we knocked on this vicar's door. It was the late afternoon. And he opened the door. I can see his face to this day. He was like a 50-year-old, slightly crouched over little man, black, swept over hair, like over a baldy spot. And I said to him, can you tell me about God? And he looked at me as if I'd said to him, you know, can you tell me about the, you know, can you tell me about the price of caviar in Moscow or something? He looked very bemused, as if it was the most strange question that had ever been asked. And he, I remember him looking at me. I had this very strange notion of someone behind him. I don't know what it was, like whether he's holding someone hostage or what, I wasn't sure. And he just shrieked at me. He said, go to Sunday school. And he just threw the door, slammed the door in my face. And I thought that wasn't what I was expecting. So that was the beginning of my spiritual journey. And then during my drinking and drugging days, I'd always find myself in a temple or a wat, or I'd find myself in a, you know, a cathedral or whatever it might be, or in a forest. And at the age of 19, I joined a religious cult when I was 19 to try and find God. That lasted about 3 years. And then after that, I went to the London School of Economics, which for anyone who knows that place, especially in the 70s, it's a hotbed of Marxist revolutionaries. So I became a revolutionary socialist, and then Karl Marx became God for a short while. And I was always searching. And one particular time, I remember going on a drinking and drugging spree where I linked up a series of cathedrals going through England, from London to Ely, to Lincoln, to Beverley Minster, to Whitby, all these sort of spiritual places, and sitting in them and trying to find God, but being drunk and stoned at the same time. So when I got to the age of 38 and a half, on the 20th of December, no, it was actually the 18th of December, 1992. And just as a footnote, my dad had been in and out of AA for some years as well, which was remarkable. He had some quite big chunks. He had 17 years of sobriety at one point. He actually ended up dying quite a gruesome alcoholic death eventually because he went back drinking again. But I won't go into that story now. It's not necessary. But it does always remind me, and I often use that story, that you know, it's you know, addiction kills people. It killed my father, eventually killed him quite sadly on his own in a small town in India. So come the 18th of December 1992, my life was in complete it was crumbling. And when I say that everything had fallen apart, most of all, I was falling apart, you know, not physically, although physically I was, because I'd gotten to that point. I don't know if anyone can identify this who are drinkers or drug users, but things started not working properly. So I couldn't get myself drunk very easily. And sometimes, like, I had a big cocaine habit. The cocaine wouldn't do what I was expecting it to do. And I was using heroin to counteract the hope. Cocaine, you know, it was getting a terrible mess. Everything was misfiring, and that was really scary. That was really scary, particularly not being able to get drunk, because that was drunk and marijuana were probably the things that I used to sedate myself mostly. And it just wasn't happening. It wasn't happening. Anyway, I was working in the States. I was in San Diego in California, and I was working with this guy. His name's John French from Camden, New Jersey. He always used his full name, like a lot of Americans do in these fellowships. And he sat with me in this bar in San Diego, and I just tried to drink myself drunk, and I couldn't. And I do think I was crying at some point, but he sat with me. And then the next day, he asked me, did I want to go to a meeting. He knew that I was an alcoholic and an addict. He knew that. He'd known it. I'd been working with him on and off for about 14 years. He knew that from the first time he ever met me. But he took the responsibility statement very, very much to heart there. You know, he sat with me and listened to my drivel for hours on end in a bar in San Diego. Anyway, I said, yes, I did go. I always tell this little side note, because he did ask me, what was I planning to do anything that evening? And I had this plan, because I don't know, there's probably Americans in this room. In those days, anyway, in San Diego, you could go across to Tijuana. You could take a bus to the border. And if you were white, you could just walk across. It was a kind of you could just walk through. There wasn't much of a border control then. So I had this idea. I was going to buy cocaine in Tijuana, take it back to San Diego, and then bus it, take it back to London. Because again, you know, the airport security was nothing like it is now. And then I was going to do some business with this guy in a pub in East London. So when he asked me what was my plans, I said nothing. And it was just as well, because I was told later, because some of the guys I was working with were working with the DEA. I was working on with NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, part of the NIH. And these guys had told me a couple of days later that there was a deal with the border control guys, had a deal with these drug dealers in Mexico, that anyone that was buying drugs off them, they would get $1,000 for naming them as they were passing back through the border. So had I done that, I probably would just be coming out of jail about now. I think I've probably been out a few years. But I said I had no plans at all to John. And he took me to this meeting. And, you know, lo and behold, I had huge identification with what people said. Huge identification, mostly with the men who talked about how they were spiritually, emotionally broken. That's what I really remember hearing. Some young guy, I remember the young guy particularly, I don't know what he said, but I remember that was the essence of it. And I thought, yeah, it's nothing to do with the externals, it's the internals. And that sort of spiritual with a small s, seeking, but I knew as a part of me, which has taken me to this very minute, this very second, was crushed. And I don't know if you can use tusnua as a verb, but my tusnua, it's a verb, has been that pathway since then. Now, I did what many people did. I got back to London where I was living. So I went back from San Diego to London. I went straight to AA meetings. I've been told by these guys in San Diego that what you do is you seek out the solution and you look for the winners. And that's what I remember. So I got to London. I was very wary about the 12-step stuff. I was very wary about the God thing, particularly because of my religious cult experience, which was very, very, was very full on about who God was. But what I did was I focused on step two, where it talked about the power greater than yourself. And like many, many people, I was only having a conversation literally this morning about where I'm going with secular AA and how that fits with that step two. And I'll talk a little bit about that experience in a minute. But I did what many people do. I thought, okay, I'm going to ignore the God. I'm going to ignore the Oxford group. I'm going to ignore all the Christian right-wing fundamentalism that's at the basis of the 12-step program. I'll fake it to make it. I'll do the best I can. I'll find a God of my understanding. So I did the steps. And for the last 30 years, that's what I've done. Not for the last 30. Yes, for the last 30 years. I've done that. I've worked the program. I've stayed pretty close to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But just before COVID time, and this is what I was doing, just before COVID time, I thought, I know what I'm going to do. This was about a year before COVID. I'm going to start reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a page at a time, one page a day, and read the daily reflection. And I did that, and I thought, this is a bit weird. Why are you just doing this? Why don't you just read some other stuff? And so I gave myself permission. And I've always talked about being I've always said I'm an agnostic in AA. I've always said that. You know, and I've always balked at we agnostics. So people say, you know, read, if you're an agnostic, read we agnostics. It's like saying, if you want to be cured of homosexuality, read a book about being cured of being homosexual. So that's what we agnostics are about, because it basically says you might think you're one, but it's okay. Pray hard enough and you'll be cured. So it didn't do it for me. So what I gave myself permission to just start reading very broadly. And I've always been interested in, you know, other philosophies, other religions, other belief systems. And prior to this, I got very interested in a group called Science and Non-Duality. I don't know if anyone else has come across them. They're very big internationally now, but it's basically this movement where they're showing how some of these, it's a combination of people who are eminent scientists and people who are involved in, you know, in religious philosophy right now, like Buddhist around non-duality and, you know, not a God concept, but a spiritual concept. And they've come together. And I spent a lot of time a few years ago following where that was leading. And it was basically saying, you know, a lot of the science that we see coming out of the recent decades confirms all what people say about, you know, a universal energy that actually keeps everything ticking along. You know, there is a force, there's an energy that is not easily explicable, but science shows, confirms a lot of what was being taught in Hinduism and Buddhism. So that was a sort of subtext that I was reading around. But then I decided just to read very broadly and just let it unfold. So over the last 3 years, I've been reading quite broadly the Quakers, the Stoics, the Taoists, the Buddhists, Celtic mythology and philosophy because of my Celtic background. I live in Australia and I got very interested in Aboriginal First Nation philosophies and mythologies and views of creation and all this kind of stuff. And then I started reading about agnosticism more broadly, because you'll often hear people in AA, I don't know if it's the same in other fellowships, but they will tell you that agnostics means you've got no knowledge, because, you know, the actual literal translation of the word agnostic is without knowledge. And my counter to that would always be, well, actually, you know, to be an agnostic just means there isn't enough knowledge either way, you know, you which to my mind is the only sensible place to be. You know, there may be a God, but there may not be a God. There isn't enough knowledge. We are just mildly evolved mammals, you know, some with hats, some without hats, trying to unravel the mysteries of the universe. You know, and if you look at what the James Webb Telescope is telling us at the moment, in our own universe, they are now telling us there are 1.5 trillion galaxies, and we're just one of them on the actual far furthest corner of our universe. One of them, and that's just in one galaxy. And then they say there are multiverses folded on each other. And then string theory tells us there are 14 dimensions to our existence, and as humans, we only tap into 4 or 5 of them. So I think to myself, well, we're not going to be able to solve that. So agnosticism is the only place that makes sense. And the reason I'm going down this trajectory is because I then started looking at the AA literature or the 12-step literature about agnosticism. I read the literature that I could get my hands on, you know, the history of agnosticism in AA, which was a real eye-opener for me. And I won't go, you know, many people in this room will know when I talk about, you know, what happened in Canada and Toronto. That's not commonly known in many parts of the AA world, and I just got more and more interested in the secular corner of our fellowships, and I started, I don't know how long, it's maybe a year ago, I can't remember when I first began to look at some of the meetings, I can't remember when I first looked, but I've been going quite intensely in the last few months, and I've realised there's this very vibrant, incredibly vibrant world out there, just like where we are now, with 23 people, of people who are, you know, from various fellowships, but have a secular, free-thinking, agnostic, atheistic, whatever it might be, view that I feel could be an incredibly significant part of the future for 12-step programs. And what I'm really interested in is here in where I live in Melbourne, is seeing how that can be introduced in a way that the program isn't lost. Because I found, and this is no critique on anyone's own, you know, as I know in this meeting, you can say what the hell you like. So this is no critique of anybody else or any other meetings. But what I've discovered in some of the meetings I've been to in Australia and in Melbourne, there's a live meeting. There's not a focus on the 12-step program in the way that I feel could be of great value to those people who turn up at AA or NA or whatever, you know, whatever 12-step meeting, get completely freaked by the God thing and disappear. And I'm wondering how significant it could be to have an alternative that is visible and available to those people, because we all know, you know, the ones that fake it to make it. But I think there's, and I know there's a huge cohort of people that will walk into an AA or an NA meeting, see the God thing on the wall, and can't fake it to make it, and they just disappear. And where do they go? So to bring this thing full circle, where I'm at as an individual at the moment is working with a few people here or gathering with a few people here in Melbourne to set up a secular meeting. Focus on the program. So I've been looking at those, you know, there's that, you know, the 20 alternative steps, and I, you know, it's up to the group how we go, but one possibility would be take a variation or one of those, one of the secular steps or the agnostic steps, and have that as an integral part of a meeting. And what we're discussing at the moment is with a group quite close by that has a step meeting on a Thursday night, and they're amenable, at least the secretary and some of the committee members are amenable to us having a secular meeting in a room in the same venue, so that's opportunity is available for anybody else in that meeting or someone who may stumble across that meeting. So I don't know where I started with this or where I've finished, but I certainly should finish by now because it's nearly 4:30. But I like a lot of these secular meetings end up with the responsibility statement. When I first went to AA, I spent most of my time in Melbourne, but the first 13 years of my recovery were mainly based in London. And most of the meetings ended up with as well as the serenity prayer, they'd end up with the I am responsible statement. And, you know, I'm responsible when anyone reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there for that. I'm responsible. And I've got a little sense of, you know, personal responsibility with the knowledge I've gained and the insight I've gained in the last few months and from the reading and for this beautiful, oh my Lord, the beautiful literature that's out there available, you know, instead of having to read, you know, 100-year-old literature. You know, it's great stuff, but it needs to be. I was reading about, you know, if this is going to survive. In fact, Bill, you know, we all know that Bill Wilson, God bless him, you know, one of the founders of AA, was very clear about the need for AA to grow and to be, you know, to be in tune with the times. It's only been, you know, the stranglehold that has been held of some of these fellowships by people who don't want to see change that needs to be broken. And that's going to be maybe problematic. But I feel that because of that knowledge I've gained and the experience I've gained and the fact I've got a big chunk of time up, which makes a difference, that I do feel responsible for trying to do something to make that available to those people who walk through the doors and balk entirely at the religiosity and the God thing. And that there may be somewhere, and I love the somewhere available to them. I love the fact that it's inclusive. You know, that battle they had up in Canada to ensure that secular meetings could remain within the AA fellowship and not outside of it was so significant. And it's great here in Australia. You know, if I type in on the Australian AA website for secular meetings, they come up. You know, they're on the directories, and I know they are elsewhere. So. I'm really looking forward to this next step. And to my mind, I see that as my spiritual journey. You know, I don't go, I've done plenty of silent retreats for days on end and meditated and, you know, done various practices. But I always see spirituality to me is about an action. It's about action. It's not about, you know, well, it's action. So I'm hoping that come the end of January, beginning of February, we'll be able to list a new meeting in Melbourne that's got a gives people a live meeting as well, because we're able to have live meetings here. A live meeting will give people the opportunity who want a secular experience. You know, doesn't mean it's not spiritual. I'm absolutely convinced that you can have a great spiritual experience without having a deity, and that's been my experience for 30 years, so I'd like to share that elsewhere. So I know it says you could talk forever, but I would have thought 30 minutes is ever enough for anyone, so I'll stop there. And thanks everyone for being here and giving me the chance to share. Really appreciate it. Thank you.